It's time for us to begin. Appreciate everyone being here. Appreciate those that join us online. We're glad to have you to study with us. We're studying Old Testament characters, we'll begin with a prayer, and then we'll get into our study. Our Father in heaven, we're thankful for this time we have together to study your word, and pray that you'll help us to be able to understand and apply it in our lives. We pray, Father, that you will be with the church here at Ephesus, help us to grow and to be what you want us to be spiritually. Help us to reach out to others and do what we can to help them and do what we can to spread your gospel. We pray, Father, that you'll be with those that are sick, and pray for those who have lost loved ones, that you'll give them peace and comfort, and help us to do what we can to be an encouragement to them. Use us in your service. We pray that you'll be with our country and bless our leaders and help us to live in peace. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Went back this afternoon. I was looking at the genealogy of Christ, and we've talked about the fact that the whole Bible is the unfolding of the story of the coming of the Messiah, Jesus. And then the New Testament is about his life and then his work through the church and the apostles after that. And as we study the Old Testament, one of the things that we have tried to emphasize is the lineage of Jesus. And we talked about the various ages of time and different divisions of the Old Testament and so on. And we've talked about how that we've come down, and we've studied about David this last week. And of course, David is in the lineage of Christ. If you look in Matthew, it traces it backwards. If you look in Luke, it's the other way around. In Matthew, it starts with Abraham and shows that Jesus is a descendant of Abraham. And that's the point there. And so it begins with Abraham and comes down through Isaac and Jacob and Judah and so on, and David and Solomon, and down through that lineage. If you go to Luke, it starts with Joseph, who was supposed to be the father of Jesus, and then it goes backwards from there all the way to Adam, and shows that Jesus was in fact a man and human as others are. And so that's the difference in the two genealogies as you trace them back. And so we talked about David last week. And David had gotten old. David was about to die. And his son, Adonijah, who was the oldest living son at the time, decided he was going to be the next king. And we are in the book of 1 Kings is where we are, chapter 1, 1 Kings. I meant to tell you that when we started. In 1 Kings chapter 1, and there it tells us that David has gotten old. Adonijah was the oldest living son at the time. Absalom was his brother, and Absalom had been killed, you remember, when he led the insurrection against David. Now, Adonijah decided he's going to be king, and he convinced Joab to go with him. And so Joab did, in fact, go with him. Abiathar the priest. Joab and Abiathar the priest went with Adonijah. And so they crowned him as king. They were having this big feast, and they were everything was going good until Nathan the prophet went to Bathsheba and said, "Did David not promise you that your son Solomon would be the next king over Israel?" Well, Nathan knew that. Nathan had already told David earlier that his son Solomon would be the next king, that was God's decree. And so Nathan knew that, but he was asking it to get her attention, I think. And she said, "Yes, that's true." And he said, "Well, Adonijah is declaring himself as king, and if you don't want to be in danger and Solomon to be in danger, then you need to do something about it." She said, "What do I need to do?" And Nathan said, "Go to David and ask him, is Solomon not supposed to be the next king?" And so she did, and she went in to David, and before she even really got through and David even answered her, Nathan came in. And he said, did you not say that Solomon is going to be the next king, that the Lord had said that Solomon would be the next king? And David said, yes, what do I need to do? And so David told Benaiah, who was faithful to him, and Zadok the priest, and Benaiah took over as head of the army for Solomon. So that tells you who he is. He was one of the mighty men of David, he says. And so they took Solomon and put him on David's mule that David rode, and led him through the city and proclaimed him to be king. And then they brought him back to the palace, and he sat on the throne. Well, by this time, all of Jerusalem was in a big uproar, and they were crying out, long live King Solomon, and Solomon is our king, and so on. And Adonijah and Joab and Abiathar heard all this noise. And let me see, did I get that right? Yeah. They heard all the noise, and they wanted to know what was going on. And so somebody came and told them, said, David has made Solomon king, and all of Judah has accepted him as the next king, and he is the king. Well, this scared Adonijah to death. Why would this frighten Adonijah? We've talked about this some before with some of the other kings. Okay. Anybody that was a threat to the new king died. And since Adonijah was an older brother, by what would seem logical rights, he should be the next king. And so he went to the tabernacle and took hold of the horns on the altar. And word came back to Solomon that he was there, and that he was afraid that he was going to be killed. And Solomon sent word to him and said that he would not be killed, that he would live. And so Adonijah then came to Solomon, and Solomon said, as long as you do what's right, you'll live. And he just sort of very generically put it that way. He said, as long as you do what's right, you live. Now, basically what that meant was, as long as you don't do anything that threatens me as king, is what it means. And so Adonijah is allowed to live and to go free, and Solomon had no desire to try to kill him. David now is about to die, and he called Solomon in, and he gave some interesting charges to Solomon. First of all, he told him, he said, you do what God tells you to do. You follow the law of God. You be faithful to God. And if you do, then God will be with you and God will bless you. If you don't, then God will not bless you. He will not take care of you. He said, now, you've got wisdom and you've got good judgment. I want you to take care of some things. Joab, you know what he did to Abner, the son of Ner, and to Amasa. And he killed both of them in peacetime as though it were war. Now, I thought that was an interesting phrase that's used there. It says that he killed them in peacetime as though it were war. And he said, you're a wise man and you'll know how to take care of it. But I don't want Joab to go unpunished. That was a very polite way of saying, you kill Joab. You execute him for what he's done. I think that this, though, we had some interesting discussion when Matt was doing the Ten Commandments, and we were talking about thou shalt not kill. And if you remember, we had some very interesting discussion about killing in war as opposed to killing not in war, and capital punishment and other things related to that. And the distinction is made very clearly here, as it is in the law of Moses even. But here David very clearly makes the distinction of killing during war and killing during peacetime. If Joab was fighting against somebody in a battle and he killed them, then he was doing God's will, and that was right, and that was okay, because it was God's people, and God said, go fight against them. Now, if he killed somebody, though, as he did Abner and as he did Amasa, he just killed them because he considered them both to be a threat to his position as captain of the army. And so he killed both of them in peacetime. And so David did not execute him at the time, but he said, tell Solomon, I want you to take care of that. And he said, don't let his hair go down unpunished. All right, any question or comment on that?
Well, it said that he had something on his waist, on his sandals, to identify that he had killed his man. Do you have any idea what it was?
I don't remember seeing that. Where was that?
That's in verse...
verse 5. He put the blood of war on his belt, about his waist, and on his sandals, on his feet. I'm not sure that that's literal. I think that probably is more figurative. He's just saying he's guilty of it. Is what I took that to mean. Not that he literally, you know, put the blood on his sandals or that he put it on his belt. But he shed the blood of war in peace. He said, show kindness to Barzillai the Gileadite. If you remember when David was fleeing from Absalom, Barzillai came out. He was one of the ones that came out and helped him. And so he says, be kind to him, show kindness to him, take care of him. And so Solomon said he would do that. And then Shimei is the one that when David was fleeing from Absalom that is a descendant of Saul. You remember, and he cursed David all the way out of the city and threw rocks at him and threw dust at him and all this. And David did not punish him, but he tells Solomon to do that, to take care of him. Again, he said, I want you to put him to death as well. And so David died. And this tells us then that Solomon did these things. These people that David wanted punished, he made sure that they were put to death. And he had Benaiah, his captain of his army, do that. All right, anything, any questions or comments down to there? All right, we mentioned last week about David when he had gotten old and he couldn't stay warm, and so they decided to get somebody to help him stay warm, and they hunted through and they found this beautiful young girl named Abishag, and she came and got in the bed with David, and she kept him warm. It says they did not have relations, but she was there with David, and she was his nurse, and she took care of David in his last days. Well, Adonijah decided that he wanted, it says she was a very beautiful girl, and Adonijah decided he wanted her for his wife. And so he went to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and he said, I want you to do me a favor. And she said, what's that? And he said, I want you to go to Solomon and make a request for me. And she said, okay, what is the request? And he said, I want you to go to Solomon and ask if I can have Abishag as my wife. And so she did that. And she went to Solomon. She made that request. Solomon's response was that he might as well ask for the kingdom if he's going to do that. And so he had Adonijah put to death. Adonijah went to the tabernacle. He grabbed hold of the horns of the altar. He wouldn't turn loose, and so he had Benaiah kill him there. And so they took him out and buried him. Why would it be such a big deal to Solomon for him to have given her to Adonijah for a wife? Okay, because she had belonged to David the king. And if she was even a concubine of David the king, then she was royal. And you didn't take her. For him to take her would have been taking royalty. And so he says that's the same as asking for the kingdom itself. And he had Adonijah put to death because of that. All right, anything down through chapter 2? Chapter 3 begins with an interesting statement. Solomon made an alliance with the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh of Egypt. And as a part of that alliance, he married the daughter of Pharaoh. And this was a very common practice. In fact, later on, we probably won't actually read it, but later on it talks about the fact that David had made alliances with a lot of different kings, and he had married the daughters of all of these different kings that he made alliances with. And so he ends up with 300 wives because of all these alliances he's made with all these different kings. Now the problem, and it doesn't specifically mention it here as being a problem, but the problem we'll see later on is that these women brought with them their idols. And this affected not only them, but Solomon and Israel as well. We'll talk about that some more. Interestingly, though, at this point, it tells us that he had married her, and then the very next thing says, Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. And he went to Gibeon to offer up a sacrifice. And the Lord appeared to him and asked him what he'd like to have. And that's an interesting thing for God to do, to appear to King Solomon and say, okay, if I grant your request, what do you want? What would be a natural response to that, probably? I think even God tells us what would be a natural response. Money. Yeah, make me wealthy. I'd love to be very, very wealthy. What would be another natural response especially for a king? Say, let me live a long time. You know, it'd be good if I could live a long time. But Solomon didn't ask for wealth. He didn't ask for a long life. What did he ask for? Wisdom. Okay. He said, I'm like a little child. He said, you have put me in charge of all the people of Israel. There's so many of them, you can't even count them. And he said, I'm like a little child. I don't even know how to go in and out. And I need wisdom to be able to deal justly with these people and do what's right. And God was very pleased with him and tells him, because you have asked for wisdom and you've asked for discernment and judgment, rather than asking for a long life or asking for wealth, I'm going to give you wisdom beyond what anybody has ever known, before you or after you. But not only that, I'm going to give you wealth that will exceed anybody else in the world. And I will give you a long life if you'll continue to follow my ways. So he promises that he will take care of him and he'll give him that. And so it says that Solomon was very wise and that God blessed him and gave him a great deal of wisdom. There's one illustration that's given of Solomon's wisdom, specifically, that just to show his wisdom and his judgment. Does anybody remember what that is?
It's like who the baby belonged to.
Okay, who the baby belonged to. There were two women, and they were both prostitutes. One of them had a child, a little boy, 3 days later, the other one had a little boy. They lived in a house together. Nobody else lived in the house with them. And one of them, the baby died during the night. And the other one said that the mother rolled over on it is the reason it died. Whether it really, that's why or not, I don't know. But anyway, the baby died. And so the mother of the dead baby got up during the night and took the live baby from the breast of the other mother and put the dead baby there, and she took the live baby. Now, the next morning, the woman woke up and she looked at the child and it was dead. But then when she began to examine the child, she realized that was not her baby. I don't know. It just seems to me it would be pretty hard to fool a mother as to whether or not a child was really her baby or not, especially if it was already a few days old. And it seems here that it was already several days old. Solomon, in his wisdom, said, well, bring me a sword. And so they brought him a sword. He said, okay, just cut the baby in two and give half of it to one of them, give half of it to the other one. Well, the mother of that was really the one that was really the mother of the living child said, don't kill the baby, just give it to her. I'd rather you give it to her and the baby live than I would for you to kill the child. And Solomon said, that's the mother, said, give the baby to her. And if you understand human nature at all, that's a very simple thing, but yet who would have thought of it, you know, in a time like this, for him to have come up with that idea. And so this is given as an example of his wisdom and shows the kind of wisdom that he had. And it says that because of this, word spread not only in Israel, but in all the nations around. Word began to spread about him and because of this judgment. And they saw that God was with him to administer justice. And so Solomon then was totally king, solidly set as king over all of Israel. The next chapter really talks about his officers and that kind of thing, and we're not going to get into all of that. I thought it was interesting. Just a couple of the things here. His provisions for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. That would be approximately, 1 core is approximately 10 bushels. So it'd be 300 bushels of flour and six 600 bushels of meal a day that they were using to feed. They also, it says, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed oxen, 100 sheep, besides the deer and gazelle and roebucks and fattened fowl. So he had a pretty big household that he was feeding, obviously.
He had 40,000 stalls for horses and chariots.
Yeah.
It'd take a lot to feed 40,000.
Yeah, 40,000 stalls for his horses, and he had 12,000 horsemen. So this just tells you a little bit about the wealth that Solomon very quickly gained. Solomon now decides it's time for him to build the temple. You remember David had wanted to build a temple for God. God told him no, he was not going to do it, because he'd been a man of war, but his son Solomon would build the temple. So David spent the rest of his life getting stuff ready, accumulating things and just getting preparations made so that when Solomon took over, he could build this temple for God. Well, one of the first things that Solomon did is contacted Hiram, who was king of Tyre. Now, Hiram had been very close ally with David. And so he told him, he said, I want you, if you would, to please provide the wood for us to use to build this temple. And Hiram said, I'll be glad to do that. And Solomon said, well, I'll pay you. And so they cut the wood, they floated it down to a designated place, and then Solomon's servants took it and carried it to use it to build with. And so Hiram provided it. They made rafts out of it. And then when they got to where they was going, they'd break the raft up and use the wood then to build this temple with. And so he used cedar and cypress is the two woods that were used throughout the whole temple, was cedar and cypress. And so Solomon took care of Hiram and provided his needs as a result of his doing this. And actually, this building the temple took 7 years. And so during this whole 7 years, Hiram is working for Solomon and providing him what he needs and so on. He also provided some other stuff besides just the wood, as if you're going through later on. Solomon forced labor of the Israelites. He took 30,000 men to work on his temple. And he took 10,000 at a time. So 10,000 would work for a month. And then they'd take off for 2 months. And they'd work a month, take off for 2 months. So they rotated between 10,000 of the 30,000 working. He had 70,000 transporters and 80,000 hewers of stone in the mountain. So that's a big construction crew, to put it mildly. So the next several chapter or two here talks about the building of the temple. And we're not going to go into all the details of the temple. The temple was built, the temple itself is built at the same pattern as the tabernacle. It was had the holy place, which was 40 by 20, had the most holy place, which was 20 by 20. And so they were separated the same. They put the Ark of the Covenant under the cherubim in the most holy place, and then they had the same articles of furniture from the tabernacle that went into the holy place. Now, the difference was that this also had a big courtyard that went around it. And then outside the courtyard, they built other buildings where people lived and where they stored stuff and all kinds of things. And so by the time they got through, it was a huge complex with the temple in the middle of it. As I mentioned earlier, it was built out of cedar. It was built out of cypress. Mostly inside of the temple itself was cedar. And then everything inside the temple was overlaid with gold. Even the floors. The walls, the floors, everything. All of the articles that went in there, the furniture, was overlaid in gold. All the utensils that were used that were inside the temple were made out of gold. The ones that were used outside were made out of bronze. But I mean, it's unbelievable when you begin reading. I mean, you think about a 60 by 20 room that was 20 feet high. And the whole thing is overlaid in gold. That's a lot of gold. But this tells you something about the wealth of Solomon to even be able to do that. David had put up a whole bunch of money and treasures and other things that were to go into the treasury of the temple. But Solomon didn't even touch all that. Once he got the temple built, he took all the stuff that David had collected and just put it there in the treasury of the temple. So he didn't use any of that in building the temple itself. But Hiram was one of the he was He provided craftsmen. He provided people who worked with gold. He provided people that worked with wood. He provided people who did a lot of different things in the process of building all of this. Once the temple was completed, it took 7 years. Then Solomon did a dedication of the temple. He offered up sacrifices, I mean, thousands and thousands of animals he offered up as sacrifices. And then he basically did two things. He prayed to God and asked God to sanctify the temple and to be with the people and to be with him as king and to bless them. And then he instructed the people that they were to be faithful to God and they were to continue to serve God faithfully. And if they did, God would be with them and God would bless them. However, if they did not, then God would punish them and would not be with them. It's in chapter 8, down verse 63, it says, he offered up peace offerings, 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep in dedicating the temple. And so for 7 days they had a feast for all the people of Israel. And then on the eighth day he sent everybody home. And when he finished then, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time. You remember he appeared to him the first time. He promised him he'd give him wisdom. The Lord appeared to him a second time. And he said, if you'll continue to walk before me as your father David walked in integrity, follow my commands, uprightness of heart, then I will establish your throne forever and I will be with you and I will be in this temple to bless the people. However, if you or the people do not continue to serve me and you put other gods ahead of me and you worship other gods, then I will bring an end to your reign and I'll bring a calamity on the people. This was the promise of God. This is nothing new. We've seen this promise made by God all the way from the days of Abraham. If you follow me, do what I tell you, I'll be with you, I'll bless you. If you don't, then I'm going to punish you. And that should, at some point, as you study through the Old Testament, that should ring a bell in our minds that says, if we follow God, he's going to be with us and take care of us. If we don't, he's not. And it's interesting to me that there are people that don't make any pretense of really trying to serve God or follow what the Bible teaches or anything else, and yet they want to claim all kinds of promises of God that he's going to take care of them and be with them. Well, God never promised to be with anybody that doesn't serve him or anybody that doesn't put their faith and their trust in him. And so if we're just going to live any way we want to live, we cannot expect God to be with us or to bless us or to take care of us. And I think that's a very practical lesson that we need to see and we need to understand. All right, any comments down through there? The cherubim were like angels, and Solomon built these cherubim so that when their wings were stretched out, it was 10 feet from the tip of one wing to the tip of the other wing. And there were two of them. And their wings touched the walls on each side of the most holy place. It was 20 by 20, remember. So their wings touched, and it was under the wings, the middle two wings of these two cherubim, that the Ark of the Covenant was put. And this is where the Ark went. Do you remember what was in the Ark of the Covenant? Let's back up a whole bunch, 400, 500 years. What was the first thing that was put in the Ark of the Covenant? All right, the tablets of stone that had the Ten Commandments. That was the first thing. All right, can you think of anything else? I know of at least just off the top, I didn't really research this. I was just thinking out loud here. But the rod of Aaron, is Aaron's rod that budded. You remember when they challenged Aaron and God said, I'll show you who is in charge. And so Aaron's rod budded. Each of the tribes brought their rod and placed it before the Lord. And the next morning when they got up, Aaron's rod budded and had almond blossoms on it. And so that was put in the Ark of the Covenant. All right. I can think of at least one other thing that was. No, it wasn't showbread, but manna. Yeah. They put a jar of manna when you remember, God was feeding them in the wilderness with manna, and God said, and it said, take a jar of manna and put it in the Ark of the Covenant. And I find that interesting because if they gathered too much manna for one day, what happened to the manna? It spoiled. It would rot and had worms in it. However, they were not to gather any on the Sabbath day because God didn't give them any on the Sabbath day. On Friday, they were to get enough for 2 days. So what happened then? If they gathered enough for 2 days on Friday, what happened? It was good. So if they did it Sunday through Thursday, it wouldn't last 2 days. It would rot and it'd have worms in it. But they gather enough for 2 days on Friday, and it would be enough for Friday and Saturday, and God preserved it for them. And then he told them to put a jar of manna in the ark. And apparently that jar of manna just stayed good as long as it was there. I don't know at what point it disappeared, because now when Solomon brings the ark into the temple and places it under the cherubim, it specifically says that the only thing that was in the Ark of the Covenant was the tables of stone, the two tablets of stone that had the Ten Commandments written on. So at some point, and I don't know if this is when, you remember the Philistines had captured the ark at one point. It had been in somebody else's house two or three times before it got back to Jerusalem. And so somewhere along the way, Aaron's rod and the jar of manna disappeared. And I don't know where or when or how. Solomon gave Hiram some cities. And I thought that was interesting. I don't know the answer to that. I think it's in chapter 7. No, wait a minute. Chapter 8, verse 6. The priest brought the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord to its place into the inner sanctuary of the house of the most holy place under the wings of the cherubim. And the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubim made a covering of the ark and its poles from above. But the poles were so long, the ends of the poles could be seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen outside. There this way to this day, there's nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone which Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. That's verse 9. Yeah. So, yeah. I knew I read it, I just didn't remember where. All right. So Solomon dedicated the temple. God accepted the dedication. Solomon gave Hiram some cities. Hiram went to look at them. He didn't like them. And he told Solomon he didn't like the cities. And Solomon said, okay. And it doesn't seem that anything was done about it one way or the other. And no big deal. But he wasn't pleased with the cities that Solomon gave. Now the fame of Solomon has spread. His riches, the fame of his wisdom has spread. And a story that most of us are familiar with, the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and heard about his wisdom and his wealth. And so she brought this huge entourage and a whole bunch of gifts, and she came to visit Solomon to just see what it was. And after she had stayed there for a period of time, she said, I did not believe the reports that I heard until I came, and my eyes have seen it. And she said, behold, the half has not been told to me. You exceed in wisdom and prosperity the report which I heard. And so we hear that phrase used a lot of times, the half has not been told. And that's where that comes from, is the Queen of Sheba, she just could not believe how much wealth he had, and she could not believe how wise he was. Now the rest of chapter 10 talks about some of the wealth of Solomon. And one of the interesting things that it talks about is it says that there was so much gold in the city of Jerusalem that silver lost its value and it was considered worth no more than stones. That's how much gold there was. He built the navy ships. Hiram helped him, and they built navy ships, and some of the sailors from Hiram's kingdom and some from Israel went together, and they would go to Ophir and they would bring back gold. And it says they brought back between 20 and 25 tons of gold each year from Ophir. I don't know how much a ton of gold is worth because it's measured in troy ounce, which is a very, very small measurement. And I have no idea how that translates into a ton. One place actually said that it was the equivalent of 23 metric tons, which would be about 50 tons. 23 metric tons would be 50 tons. So it was a lot. I mean, just 20 to 30 tons of gold a year. And this was every year Solomon was bringing this stuff back. Any question down through chapter 10? Question. Chapter 11 begins. I don't know if somebody's supposed to ring a bell or not. It's about time for us to quit, isn't it? Dwight, you want to get a count and ring a bell for us, please? We'll stop there then, and we'll pick up with chapter 11. We'll talk about Solomon, the rest of Solomon's story, and then we will talk about his son Rehoboam and Jeroboam next week, Lord willing.